Hello, SunSounds listeners, and Happy New Year. This is Andy Bombeck, which means once again it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that we just started, titled The 57 Bus. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled A Recipe for Magic Potion. And then it's Mr. Norton's New Hat, Clouds, Life's Big and Little Moments, French Toast Sundays, Pilar's Worries, and if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with To the End of the World, Far, Far Away. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled A Recipe for Magic Potion. To make a magic potion, you will need these things: a friend, or two or three, a bucket, or a pot, or a hole, and ingredients. To find the ingredients, you must go on a quest. Take a bag to carry them in, and an umbrella if it's raining. Tell your parents you are going adventuring and might be late for dinner. Magic ingredients are hidden all over the world. Do not give up. Collect as many as you can. Here is what you'll need: a new leaf plucked from the highest branch, an old leaf marked with three colors or more, a splash from a puddle or foam from the sea, two smooth white shells from a beach or a snail, a sprinkle of sand from a far-off place, a pinch of grass from a neighbor's lawn, a spider's web but no spiders, the greenest moss, stones from the underground mined with your fingers, and any black dirt clods you find on the way, a sprig from a bird's nest, a prickle from a sock, and a feather lost from the sky for luck, drops from a hose sprayed from the end, the tail of a rainbow dipped quickly in the pot, two big mud cakes, each made with a different mud, served fresh, one petal from the brightest flower, one dandelion set to 3 o'clock, one secret whispered softly, do not let anyone overhear it, a twig that forks and forks again, a rock from the water, cool to the touch, a bark chip boat with an ant for a captain, keep her safe, and seven more secret things from the places only you could know. Lastly, place the pot beneath your favorite tree, add some lint from your pocket and dust from your shoe, find a mixing stick proven in battle to stir. Then recite the magic words. You know them already. Stir 3 times, then 6 times, then 3 times more. Cover your eyes, stand back. You do not need to drink the potion, but dip your finger in it. See how it smells. Take note of the color, how it bubbles, how it drips. Breathe the magic in, and then, later, when too many years have passed you by, and the friends you quested with are living far away, when your hands are cleaner than they ever were before, close your eyes and remember your potion. Remember your ingredients, how you found them, how they looked, how they smelled, and you will be young forever. Mr. Norton's New Hat. On Monday morning, Horace Norton found that a mouse had made a house in his hat. Now, this was something of a surprise. But Mr. Norton was a kind man, and he didn't want to disturb it. So he went to work all the same, with a mouse, with a house in his hat. On Tuesday morning, Horace found that some birds had built a nest in the basket of his bicycle. Mr. Norton really didn't want to make a fuss, so he went to work all the same, with the birds in his bicycle basket and a mouse with a house in his hat. On Wednesday morning, Horace found that a squirrel was asleep in his shoe. What to do? Mr. Norton was never one to complain. Goodness, no. So he went to work all the same, with a squirrel in his shoe, the birds in his bicycle basket, and a mouse with a house in his hat. On Thursday morning, Horace found a selection of stoats in his satchel. And on Friday morning, a collection of cats curled up in his coat. Well, this was incredibly inconvenient, but there wasn't much Mr. Norton could do, as he was running late. So you guessed it. He went to work all the same, with the cats in his coat, the stoats in his satchel, a squirrel in his shoe, the birds in his bicycle basket, and a mouse with a house in his hat. On Saturday morning, Horace found that everything was unusually quiet. But when he went to take a bath, he found a mole in his mug, a skunk in his sink, owls in his towels, toads in his toilet, and a bear, would you believe, in his bath. Fortunately, Mr. Norton didn't have to go to work, so he went back upstairs to bed. But when he got there, he found that his bed was full. And then he felt something tickling his beard. Mr. Norton was kind and gentle and patient, and he really didn't like to make a fuss, but cheep, cheep, cheep. Enough is enough. Can you believe it? Mr. Norton actually shouted, and almost immediately he felt bad about it. The next morning, Horace found himself alone. It was now Sunday, and he didn't have to go to work, but the house suddenly felt empty. He made a cup of tea and went out into the garden to dig up some vegetables. When Mr. Norton went to bed that night, he still felt very sad. The following morning, it was Monday once again, and Horace found that a package was waiting for him by the front door. It was a gift. And can you guess what it was? A magnificent new hat. But wait, what's this? The mouse? Luckily, Mr. Norton knew exactly what to do. And that morning, he felt marvelous. Clouds, life's big and little moments. Today, darling daughter, I sat in the grass, eyes gazing skyward while soft clouds rolled past. And I thought of you, love, of the you you've become. As the clouds painted pictures of when you were young. Your once tiny hands, toothless, grin, snuggly kisses. Then one step at a time, eyes bright, making wishes. I saw three little lambs just like you, and your brothers joined at the hip, so in tune with each other. While I searched for seashells on the wide open beach, the clouds overhead had more stories to teach. Three ducklings swam past, sometimes bold, sometimes shy, like you and your brothers before you could fly. I spotted a fairy, gift-wrapped in fine tulle, sturdy wings like the ones you once modeled for school. Riding dreams in the sand, by a sapphire sea, wispy clouds weaving thoughts of how you used to be. You jumped into the deep end, learned to whistle a song, rode your bike up the big hill, pedaling strong. Then a thunderous clap shook the leaves in the trees as dark, moody clouds rumbled in on a breeze. And I thought of the day your big brother left home. You cried woeful tears in your room all alone. But when the clouds parted, a rainbow bloomed slow. Kaleidoscope colors, I'm watching you grow. A child once little, O daughter of mine. Now my heart's bittersweet at this passage of time. But the you you've become, like the clouds up above, fills my soul with the hope and the magic of love. French toast sundaes. French toast and sundaes had always gone together, like peanut butter and jelly or apples and honey, and you couldn't have French toast sundaes without Grandma. On French toast sundaes, Grandma would ask Minna to tie her apron, not too tight, not too loose, just right. And they would get down to the business of beating those eggs as hard as they could. A pinch of this, not quite right. A shake of that, just right. Beat, dip, fry. Not too crispy, not too soft. Just right. Then they would take their plates into the yard, and Minna would shimmy up the old tree, climb onto her favorite branch, and settle into the little nook in its gnarled trunk. "Come on up, Grandma," Minna would say. "No, thank you, dear. I'm staying right here." And that's how Sunday mornings had been for as long as Minna remembered. But this Sunday, Aunt Jan was in the kitchen. Mom and Uncle Al were wearing ripped shirts, and people were telling them that they were so sorry. There were boiled eggs instead of French toast, and on the windowsill burned a candle. "I hate boiled eggs," yelled Minna, and ran outside to the old tree. Up, up, up she climbed to her favorite branch. On Monday, Mrs. Davis arrived with a pot of hot vegetable soup and a mushroom pie. More people came to sit with Mom and Uncle Al. In and out they came all day long. They talked. They cried. Sometimes they laughed. Minna watched. She didn't talk. She didn't laugh. Sometimes she cried. Too busy. Too noisy. Just too much. "Come on down, Minna," said Aunt Jan. "Staying right here," said Minna. And in the evening, the house filled with people who came to say prayers for Grandma. On Tuesday, Mr. Elman brought a dish of bubbling hot lasagna. "We got ourselves into some right old pickles in grade school. One summer, I dared her to climb the biggest oak in the park. She didn't tell me she was scared of heights. She got into a fine flap. The park ranger had to carry her down. She swore she'd never climb another tree as long as she lived." "How about that?" Mom smiled and took a sip of tea. Minna inched a little further down the tree. On Wednesday, Mr. Rosin brought a pan of crispy fried chicken. Aunt Jan went in and out of the kitchen with cups of tea. The house was busy all day long. On Thursday, Mrs. Elman brought her famous apple strudel. "Thought you might like this," said Mr. Green. "That there's your mother." "Mom never rode a motorcycle," said Uncle Al. "She sure did," said Mr. Green, "all the way to Brighton Beach." "Who knew?" said Uncle Al, and took a bite of strudel. Minna swung onto the branch below, dropped onto the porch, and squished her nose right up against the window pane. On Friday, Mrs. Gutman brought a turn of soup, baked fish, and a bowl of steaming carrots. "I'll say one thing," said Uncle Al. "She was a terrible cook." "She certainly was," said Mom. "But she made a mean French toast." "Sure did," Uncle Al smiled, "and she never told us how she made it. A secret," she said. "Wish we knew," said Mom. Minna went into the kitchen. She asked Aunt Jan to tie her apron. "Not too tight, not too loose, just right." And she got down to the business of beating those eggs as hard as she could. Beat, dip, fry. "Not too crispy, not too soft. Just right." "Thought you might like these," said Minna to Mom and Uncle Al. "Delicious," said Uncle Al. "Just like she used to make." "Superb," said Mom. "Grandma told you her secret?" "She sure did," said Minna. "Who knew?" said Uncle Al. They smiled, then they laughed right out loud. Pilar's Worries. Pilar plays while brushing her teeth. Friday is always a good day, a ballet class day. She sashays into the kitchen, prepares to leap, and her feet stop. Auditions for Winter Wonderland are Saturday. Tomorrow, Pilar worries. "I can't dance in front of all those people. What if I forget the steps?" Pilar lets out her breath. It's her favorite ballet. She knows all the steps. She hugs herself as she enters the school. "Pilar," she tells herself, "Friday is always a good day." But in PE, she drops a fly ball. She turns pink. During library, Pilar realizes she forgot to bring her very overdue book. Her skin prickles hot. By lunch, her stomach is squeezed so small, she can only swallow one bite, even though it's pot sticker day. In math, Miss Jenkins's voice startles Pilar from her daydream. "Who would like to solve the problem on the board?" Pilar's arm refuses to rise, but her hand twitches. "Pilar?" Miss Jenkins asks. Pilar immediately forgets the answer. "Pass," she mutters. Someone whispers loudly, "She always says pass." Her eyes tear up. Her heart beats so fast it scares her. She panics. "Do I need to go home?" She drops her head and sees a sticky note on her desk that says, "Breathe." Sebastian, a friend from ballet, grins. Pilar smiles and remembers to breathe. Finally, the last bell. Finally, ballet. At the studio, Pilar's palms touch the warm wood of the bar. Her toes and heels press down on the floor. Miss Ward, their instructor, claps. "Let's begin with plays." The school day disappears. After warm-ups, Miss Ward asks, "Pilar, could you please demonstrate your Auberski?" She sees students staring and Sebastian smiling. Pilar's palms are sticky on the bar, but as soon as her leg lifts, her shoulders relax. The rest of the hour breezes by. "Dancers," calls Miss Wart. "Auditions for Winter Wonderland are tomorrow. Please see me if you're interested." Pilar's heart leaps. Then her worries creep back. "Should I?" Sebastian signals Pilar, but she turns and packs up. "Pilar, it's Miss Ward. Signing up?" Cheeks burning, she shakes her head. At bedtime, Mama sits on Pilar's bed. "How was your day, love?" she asks. Pilar's chest tightens. Then she begins to cry. "Tryouts are tomorrow, Mama, but I'm too nervous." Pilar's Mama hugs her. "Whether you try out this year or next year or never, Mijita, you're still an amazing dancer." "I want to this year, Mama, but my whole body is scared." Mama touches Pilar's chest, their sign for breathe. "Mijita, if you decide to audition, you will feel scared. But usually, when you are doing what you love, the good feelings are so big that the bad feelings become small. Pilar can't sleep. She thinks of Winter Wonderland and imagines her favorite part, the dancing snowflakes. She steps out of bed. Quietly, like nighttime snow, she dances. She feels peaceful and strong. Tired at last, she collapses into her comforter. "I can do this," she murmurs. Pilar wakes so early Saturday that she can still see the moon in the violet sky. She pulls her hair into a bun. She makes a snack and fills her water bottle. Mama walks in yawning. "Well, good morning, early bird." "Mama," Pilar blurts, "I want to audition." At the studio, Pilar spies Miss Ward. Pilar's belly is queasy. She thinks back to dancing last night. She breathes deep. Her teacher smiles. "Pilar, I am so happy you're here. Everyone's warming up backstage." Pilar feels like she's swallowed 100 butterflies. But just as she starts to worry, Sebastian walks up. "I'm so nervous, I want to barf," he moans. Pilar laughs, and the butterflies float away. A judge calls, "Pilar?" The flutters return, but Pilar closes her eyes and breathes deep. "I can do this. This is what I love." Her legs prickle and her feet feel numb, but she walks to center stage. The music starts. Pilar closes her eyes and imagines winter and ice. Her flushed cheeks cool. She steps and dances. Before she knows it, the music silences, and Pilar walks off stage, beaming and tall. Next week, during sharing, Miss Jenkins goes around the circle. "Pass," says Pilar. But Sebastian raises his hand. "Pilar and I are going to be in Winter Wonderland. We're snowflakes." Her classmates speak up all at once. "Cool, wow, whoa." Pilar's skin warms, but this time it's nice heat, like the warmth of a fire after playing in the snow. Okay, the next story is about some bears, and it's titled "To the End of the World, Far, Far Away." When Lewis spilled his milk, Mom was upset, and Lewis cried. Lewis is a baby bear, and Mama is a full-grown bear. "I'm leaving today. I'm going away. You don't love me anymore." "Where will you go?" asked Mom. "To the end of the world, far, far away," said Lewis. "And you won't see me anymore. Will you be sad when I'm gone?" "I'll be so sad, I'll cry night and day. I'll cry so much that my tears will make a great sea. The splashing waves will call to me, 'Lewis's mother, why do you cry?' And I'll say, 'My baby bear has gone away. Sea, sea, please help me find him.' The waves will ripple my words to the creatures of the deep." "And after that, will you still be sad?" asked Lewis. "Lewis, Lewis, I'll be sad, so sad, I'll climb the mountain where the wind howls by, and all my sobs will fill the sky. The wind will shriek, 'Lewis's mother, why do you cry?' And I'll say, 'My baby bear has gone away. Wind, wind, please help me find him.' The wind will toss my words to the birds in the sky." "Will there be any sadness left?" asked Lewis. "Oh, Lewis, my Lewis, I'll be so full of tears. I'll go to the forest where the trees grow high, and all my sobs will rustle the leaves. The trees will bend and ask of me, 'Lewis's mother, why do you cry?' And I'll say, 'My baby bear has gone away. Trees, trees, please help me find him.' The trees will carry my words to the creatures of the woods. Then will your sadness be all used up?" asked Lewis. "Oh, no. I'll go to your room, and your toys will say, 'Lewis's mother, why do you cry?' And I'll say, 'Our baby bear has gone away.' Then they'll cry too. Who will look after us tonight? Who will tuck us in? Who will hold us tight? I'll say to the toys, don't weep, don't cry. He's the best baby bear in the world, and he's gone away. But listen, listen, what can we hear? Look, look, who can we see? It's me, cried Louis. Mom, don't weep, don't cry. Tell my toys, tell the trees, tell the wind, tell the waves. Here I am, I'm home to stay. Once upon a time, on another day, shall we go together to the end of the world, far, far away? I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with a picture book titled The Hedgehog Who Didn't Want to Prickle. There once was a hedgehog named Tiny Tot. He was known by his name because he was as small as a breadcrumb. He was very cheerful, and he would always arrive to his family's den with a great big smile on his face. His favorite thing to do when he arrived home was jump on Mom and Dad and hug them with all his heart. But our little friend found some trouble. Sometimes, when he gave Mom and Dad his best hug, he unexpectedly pricked himself. He was so concerned, he even thought it was his fault, that there was something he wasn't doing right. After thinking about it for a while, he decided he was going to look into it. Without further ado, Tiny Tot knocked at the next den's door, where his Aunt Henrietta lived. Aunt Henrietta, when I hug Mom and Dad, I prick myself really bad almost every time. What is it I'm doing wrong? Asked the little hedgehog. Do you? But is it you or them who draw the spikes out? Maybe you catch them in a bad mood. Do you know if they had a bad day? Answered Aunt Henrietta. I don't know. Well, if you want the pricking to go away, you must learn to use your eyes every day. Tiny Tot looked puzzled. He didn't fully understand what his aunt was trying to say. That's why he decided to keep on investigating and went straight to Uncle Bobby's place. Howdy, Tiny Tot. Hi, Uncle Bobby. May I ask you a question? Sure, let's hope I know the right answer. Well, you see, many times when I give Mom and Dad an enormous hug, I prick myself really bad. What could I have been doing wrong, Uncle Bobby? Do you? But is it you or them who draw the spikes? Maybe they aren't feeling well. Are they ill? I don't know. Well, if you want the pricking to go away, you must learn to use your eyes every day. Bobby's answer caught the little hedgehog by surprise. He had been told exactly the same thing. If he wanted to have a final answer, he thought he should visit his Grandma Mary, who knew all about everything. And as he stepped inside her home, Tiny Tot asked, Grandma, what is it I'm doing wrong? Many times when I give Mom and Dad an enormous hug, I prick myself really bad. Well, do you? But is it you or them who draw the spikes? Perhaps Mom and Dad were angry about something right before you arrived. That could be, couldn't it? Well, I don't know. Remember, Tiny Tot, if you want the pricking to go away, you must learn to use your eyes every day. Yes, yes. Now it seemed clear. That was the right answer. But what did it mean? If he wanted the prickles to go away, he should be aware of who had drawn the spikes, as his family members had told him. When the little hedgehog arrived home from school the next day, he remembered his family's words. When he stepped foot inside the den, he opened his eyes widely, so nothing would escape from him. Mom looked happy, and her relaxed spikes moved softly as she walked. So Tiny Tot got closer to her and gave her an enormous hug. Dad seemed a bit edgy, and his spikes were a bit tense and pointy. That's why the little one decided it'd be best just to kiss him very softly. And it worked. Learning to watch had proved to be a wonderful strategy. Even though he had been able to get close to Mom and Dad and show his love for them, he hadn't pricked himself at all. Everything had gone just as planned. It was fantastic. As days went by, Tiny Tot's concerns were gone, and he barely remembered what he had learned. He thought that if he kept his attention toward others, everything would be just fine. Every day when he came home from school, the little hedgehog watched Mom and Dad. When they seemed joyful, their spikes pointed down. He'd spring at them and give them a huge hug. When they didn't look as relaxed, he just kissed them softly or gave them a cottony hug. Until one afternoon, on his way home, Tiny Tot ran into an annoying fly. When he tried to avoid and wave at it, he stumbled, fell down to the floor, and ended up with a nub on his head. "That hurts," said Tiny Tot as he slowly rose up. Luckily, the fly had flown away, but the little hedgehog was now really angry. Like he did every day, he opened the door and watched Mom and Dad. Everything appeared to be calm and relaxed, so the little one approached them in order to give one of his best hugs. Suddenly, while giving Mom a hug, he heard a shout, "Ouch! Tiny Tot, that really hurts. You're pricking me." What a surprise. The small hedgehog hadn't seen this coming. What had just happened? He had prickled. And that's how Tiny Tot discovered how his family members' words didn't apply just to others, but they were very important for him too. Sometimes others prick, but other times we are the ones who prick. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue with the novel that I just started titled The 57 Bus, a true story of two teenagers and their crime that changed their lives. One teenager in a skirt, one teenager with a lighter, one moment that changes both of their lives forever. If it weren't for the 57 bus, Sasha and Richard never would have met. Both were high school students in Oakland, California, one of the most diverse cities in the country. But they inhabited different worlds. Sasha lived in the middle-class foothills and attended a small private school. Richard lived in the economically challenged flatlands and attended a large public one. After school each day, their paths overlapped on the bus for a mere 8 minutes. But one afternoon, a single reckless act left Sasha severely burned and Richard charged with two hate crimes and facing life imprisonment. The case garnered international attention, thrusting both teenagers into the spotlight. But in the 57 bus, author Dashika Slater shows that what might at first seem like a simple matter of right and wrong, justice and injustice, victim and criminal, is something more complicated and far more heartbreaking. Okay, last week we learned about Sasha's new best friend, Samantha, who told Sasha she was transgender herself like Sasha. Smart like Sasha, another friend, Andrew, is transitioning from a guy into a girl. Sasha is having a hard time with her sexuality. She is not identifying as a boy or girl, but gender queer. And that's where I left off last week. Becoming Sasha. Discovering the existence of gender queer identity felt like discovering a secret room. All this time, there had been just two rooms, male and female. Now it turned out there was another room, one that could be furnished however you wanted. The more time Sasha spent in this room, the more comfortable it felt. But the person who lived in this new room still had a boy's name, Luke. By the second half of sophomore year, that name clearly no longer fit. One afternoon when Andrew was hanging out at Sasha's house, the two of them began looking at unisex names on Wikipedia. Jamie, Shannon, Taylor, Fran, Jackie, Chris, Bobby, Kai, Parker, Quinn, Sasha. Sasha was the Russian nickname for both Alexandra and Alexander, which was Sasha's middle name. And Sasha was crazy about all things Russian. The name was perfect. Gradually, Sasha asked their parents and close friends to call them Sasha instead of Luke. That spring, Sasha wrote a piece for the Maybeck Schoolzine, The Pineapple, about their explorations of gender. They used their new name as the byline. Most people at school had no idea who this Sasha person was, but as students and staff made the connection between Sasha and the person formerly known as Luke, they absorbed the information without much comment. It wasn't really drama, Michael recalls. It was just a change. Ian has two moms, so he was pretty comfortable with LGBTQ stuff. He remembers his thought process going like this. Okay, not male. Okay, not female. So neither. Okay. That was the process, and it took about 10 seconds, he says. Then it was over. I just rolled with the fact that Sasha was a gender, T says. I think it was my first experience with it, but I was raised by hippies. At another school, a student who stepped outside the usual gender categories might have been the topic of gossip or debate or at least a few raised eyebrows. But Maybeck's small student body already included one student who was agender and two who were transgender. Multiple people would come out and you'd be like, okay, they're this and they use this name and this pronoun now, says Sasha's friend Carrie. I mean, like, not everyone was good at it, but the people who were friends with trans people were. Well, the friends who made the effort to get it right gave Sasha the confidence to correct the acquaintances who got it wrong. And more, the pronoun he felt wrong. Well, I don't want for people to think of me as a he. And when they say he, not only does it reinforce in their brains that I am a he, it also reinforces it in the brains of people who are listening, Sasha explains. It doesn't really directly affect me, at least to hear it. It's more like, huh, that's not right. And when people use the right pronouns, when they use they or another gender neutral pronoun, it feels validating. A card called Luke, Sasha. Person was added to the index card deck. If someone calls Sasha by the wrong name, the card instructed the offender must discard a card from his or her hand. Bathrooms. Sometimes Debbie felt, as she stood at the gas station, the whole non-binary thing was a pain in the ass. It was Thanksgiving 2012, Sasha's junior year of high school. Debbie, Carl, Sasha were driving to Southern California to spend the holiday with Debbie's sister, A couple of hours in, Sasha had requested a bathroom stop, which was why they were now parked at a gas station off Interstate 5. But Sasha had surveyed the two options, men and women, and walked back to the car. "There's no bathroom for me," they said, climbing into the back seat. Debbie was furious. Was this really how Sasha was going to go through life, with their bladders full to bursting? "It's not healthy," she fumed. "There's not always going to be a bathroom available for you. You have to be more flexible." But Sasha refused to budge. They held it in for the rest of the 6-hour drive. It was tough sometimes watching Sasha navigate a world that didn't even have a category for them. Occasionally, Debbie wished Sasha would ease up a little, resist correcting well-meaning relatives who said he instead of they, for example. But there was something admirable about it, too, Carl pointed out. Knowing how shy Sasha was, he admired Sasha's newfound willingness to speak up, to stand out, to be seen. I wonder if Sasha hadn't been in school where alternatives to the norm were part of the culture and accepted, if they would have been struggling more to figure out where they fit in the scheme of things, he said. It feels like making this discovery has really helped Sasha become themselves. Bathrooms Revisited. Over the course of the next year, Sasha found a way to deal with the problem of bathrooms. At Maybeck, they used the staff bathroom. Out in the world, they used whatever bathroom had the shortest line, whatever bathroom was closer, or whatever bathroom was least conspicuous. If they had to use the bathroom multiple times in one place, they alternated. Nobody seemed to care which bathroom they used, or if they did, Sasha didn't notice. Skirts. Sasha wore a skirt for the first time during sophomore year, on Maybeck's annual cross-dressing day. This was before they started thinking about gender, when dressing up as a girl was just a gag that the whole school was taking part in. Everyone, regardless of orientation, clothed in exaggerated masculine or feminine costumes, Sasha borrowed a skirt from their friend Carrie, who lived in Sasha's neighborhood. What struck them then was how comfortable it was to wear one. In January 2013, when Sasha was a junior, they turned to Carrie again. "I don't have any feminine clothes," they complained. Sasha had been identifying as a gender for almost a year by now, but they still dressed the same as they always had. Like a boy. "I have lots of feminine clothes," Carrie replied. "Too many." Well, she brought a garbage bag full of hand-me-downs to school, mostly skirts she'd worn in middle school. Sasha sifted through them, and after trying on a few skirts in the bathroom, chose 3 to take home. Aside from during one school trip to China, they never wore pants again. Previously, Sasha's style had tended toward steampunk. Top hat and tweeds, vest, bow ties, even a pocket watch, and a pair of fighter pilot goggles. Sasha liked the satirical gender mashup that came from adding a skirt to this ensemble. Masculine above, feminine below. But there were always plenty of days when they didn't bother getting fancy, pairing one of Carrie's old skirts with a t-shirt and knee socks. The outfits weren't flamboyant, but they made Debbie nervous. She knew Sasha would be fine at school, if anything. The skirts gave them a little extra cachet at Maybeck, where unconventionality was an asset. It was the bust that worried her. Wearing skirts meant that Sasha was shedding that cloak of invisibility. Now they weren't just visible, but conspicuous. and outside of the cocoon of Maybeck High School, being conspicuous wasn't always a good idea. Transgender people are the victims of an astonishing amount of violence. 1 out of 4 out of every 4 trans people has experienced a bias-driven assault, and the numbers are higher for trans women, trans people of color, and people who identify as neither male nor female. Of the 860 non-binary people who responded to the 2008 National Transgender Discrimination Survey, 32% had been physically assaulted. "Did anyone give you a hard time?" Debbie would ask when Sasha got home from school. The answer was always, "No, it's fine. I'll be all right." One day, at a bus stop, an older woman approached Sasha. "Why are you wearing a skirt?" she demanded. "You're not a girl." "I'm wearing a skirt because I like wearing skirts," Sasha replied. That was the worst of it, a single unfriendly question from a woman old enough to be Sasha's grandmother. Even so, Debbie worried. Running. Carl was out for a run on Hillgrass Avenue, a residential street close to the border between Oakland and Berkeley. It was late November 1987. He was in his early 20s, unmarried, and working at a nearby cafe. Fugitive scents wisp past his nose as he ran. Oak leaves, fog, jasmine, car exhaust, ocean breeze, his own sweat. He was lost in the staccato thud of his shoes hitting the pavement, the huff of his breath, the metronome of his heart. "Hey, I like your legs." A truck slowed down to roll behind them. Heart beat louder now, his chest a megaphone. A side-eye peep, 3 young guys in a pickup. One leaned out the window. "Let me suck your prick." Adrenaline gushed into Carl's veins. He veered down busy Alcatraz Avenue, legs churning. The truck followed. He doubled back to Hillgrass, heartbeat pounding out the words of his puzzlement. "What do they want from me?" His pursuers threw the truck into reverse and revved past him, slowing down to let one of the men get out. Carl sprinted down a side street. The truck zoomed forward again, following. Carl's t-shirt was damp with a melange of different kinds of sweat, heat, effort, fear. Adrenaline kicked him down the street, kited him down the street. Then the truck pulled over just in front of them. The driver got out, blocking the sidewalk. "Hey, why don't you want to talk to us?" Carl halted in mid-stride. Alarm swamped his ears. "Because I'm busy," he choked out. He didn't even hear the second guy come up behind him. When he came to, he was lying on the sidewalk in a circle of concerned bystanders, his head and face aching. The police were on their way. The guys who had attacked him were long gone. That evening, he wrote about the incident in his journal. "Pretty bizarre," he commented. He didn't bother ruminating on why he'd been singled out, why the men had assumed he was gay. It was just a random event, a one-time thing, not likely to be repeated. The petition. All school meetings at Maybeck are held every Wednesday in the sanctuary of the Presbyterian Church downstairs. Students sprawl in the pews to hear musical performances, make announcements, and sometimes hear a guest speaker. One day in March of junior year, Sasha mounted the semicircle stage and announced 3 things. "I'm Sasha, and I identify as agender. Number 2, it's important to respect people's preferred pronouns. And if you're not sure what those are, you should ask. Number 3, I'm petitioning the White House to recognize non-binary gender." Anyone can start a petition on the We the People website at White House.gov requesting that the federal government address a problem or change a policy. If a petition gets enough signatures within a 30-day window, the White House will issue an official response. Sasha's petition read as follows. Legal documents in the United States only recognize male and female as genders, leaving anyone who does not identify as one of these two genders with no option. Australia and New Zealand both allow an X in place of an M or an F on passports for this purpose. And the UK recognizes MX, pronounced mix, as a gender-neutral title. This petition asks the Obama administration to legally recognize genders outside of the male-female binary and provide an option for those genders on all legal documents and records. To Sasha's astonishment, the petition garnered more than 27,000 signatures. That would have been enough to trigger an official response from the White House were it not for a petition circulated a couple of months earlier asking the White House to build a Death Star like the one in the movie Star Wars. After the Death Star petition got more than 34,000 signatures, the White House raised the number of signatures required for an official response from 25,000 to 100,000. Still, 27,000 signatures wasn't too shabby. That was 27,000 people reading and agreeing with my words, words that I had written, Sasha said. That felt pretty great. Clipboards. At the end of the school year, Sasha went to Sequoia Elementary School, where Carl worked, to help pack up his kindergarten classroom for the summer. As they boxed up books and folders and unpinned words from the word wall, Sasha noticed the pair of clipboards parents used to sign out their kids at the end of the day. One clipboard was marked girls, the other was marked boys. What about the kids who aren't either one? Sasha asked. Which clipboard do they go on? Well, it's just a logistical thing, Carl explained. I want to have clipboards on both sides of the door, so there isn't a big line. It's just easier this way. He couldn't imagine that kindergartners would care about gender one way or the other. In August, when Carl returned to his classroom to set up for the new school year, he unpacked the clipboards from the box where Sasha had stowed them. As he hung them up on their hooks by the door, Sasha's comment came back to him. Would it really be that hard to divide things up some other way? Using a black Sharpie, he wrote new labels for the clipboards, A to M and N to Z. It was a little thing, easy enough to change, he decided. 3 years later, Carl's classroom included a boy who sometimes liked to dress as a princess and a girl who talked about maybe being a boy someday. Turned out Sasha was right, Carl said. Kindergartners don't want to be pigeonholed. Best day ever. Best day ever. It was a trademark Sasha phrase, as in, that was the best day ever. If you have a lot of obsessions, a lot of things you really like, the opportunity for best days ever increases. On a college visit to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge the summer before senior year, Sasha met a fellow fan of the intricately plotted web comic Homestruck on a subway platform. The person complimented Sasha's skirt and said, I would be wearing mine, but it's in the wash. The two exchanged Tumblr URLs. Best day ever. Because Subway, because Cambridge, because Homestruck, because Tumblr, because skirt. Sleek or flowy. Cinched at the waist. Pleated, knitted, patterned, plain. At El Camino Real High School, In 1968, girls wore skirts or went home. Pants, pants, let girls wear pants. Debbie and her friends stood up on two fabric swaddled legs and won. Still, there were rules. No jeans, no minis. Once Debbie made herself a dress from an Indian bedspread, neck high, paisley print, hippie meets granny. The school sent her home. That ruffled draping skirt, they said, was just too long. Sasha and Nemo. The call to evacuate came about an hour after the students from Maybeck arrived in Yosemite for the school's annual camping trip. It was August 2013, just before the start of Sasha's senior year. The Rim Fire, the third largest wildfire in California history, was sizzling toward the campsite near Groveland, turning the sky a smoky orange. Sasha climbed into the back of a U-Haul-style truck with Nemo, who was a year younger. The truck was airless, hot, and cramped. "We kind of died," Nemo explained later. "We didn't actually die," Sasha said. "We were both freaking out," Nemo said. "That was our first date." The two of them were talking to filmmaker Lonnie Shavelson, who was making a documentary film about non-binary gender called Three to Infinity. Nemo identifies as gender fluid. And unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. I hope everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the book, The 57 Bus. Until then, Happy New Year's to everyone. I hope you have a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.